listeners, and welcome back to the Percy Jack, Son of Poseidon podcast. This is going to be episode 7, my review for the first half of the book, The Titan's Curse. So, I did not remember this book pretty much at all going into reading it, and I wasn't 100% sure what to expect. The only thing I remembered is that we did get the hunters, and we did get to spend time with Thalia and the Pegasus horse Blackjack. And that's pretty much the only thing I remember from this book. So I was a little surprised when we first read the book, when I first came back to reread this book, and we kind of just jump right into the plot and story of the book, and it was not at all what I expected. So we get Sally, Percy's mom, dropping off Percy, Thalia, and Annabeth off at a military school where Rover has been scouting potential half-bloods. And so this is half of the school year has gone by since the Sea of Monsters, and we learned that Annabeth and Thalia were going to school together, but Percy was at a different school in New York, and he's still living with his mom, which is nice. You know, these books kind of almost have the opposite feel of Harry Potter in a way, where, you know, each Harry Potter book takes place throughout the whole school year. And, you know, these books kind of focus on the, you know, the first two books focus on the summer breaks in between the school years. And then this book starts during the winter school break, the mid-school break. And so it's kind of like the opposite. And I do wish we kind of maybe spent more time with, or at least got to know, you know, what went on around the actual school year between Percy and Annabeth and everything. But it's pretty interesting. And so, you know, while I understand that, you know, all the action takes place where, you know, during these breaks, you know, it still would have been nice to see, you know, especially now that Annabeth's living with her father again. And, you know, and Thalia's been, you know, going to school. It would have been nice to get a little bit more of their journey there, and, you know, kind of get a sense of what normal, you know, everyday struggles for half-bloods in the world outside of camp are really like. And so I wish we got that. You know, I do like these characters, and I think it would be fun to see more of them hanging out with each other, just as, you know, not on these adventures. That could be kind of fun. So our heroes meet up with Grover at the military school, and we learn that he's found two new half-bloods, a sister and brother named Bianca and Nico D'Angelo. And going into this book, I did not remember meeting Nico and Bianca at the beginning of this book. I actually thought they came in the fourth book. And I actually didn't remember Bianca at all. I just remembered Nico, really. And so this was kind of a nice surprise for me. And because they will play a critical role in the overall story arc of the series. And then we get a scene of Percy and Annabeth at the dance, and Percy is kind of awkward around Annabeth because she's grown a little bit taller than he has over the school year, and, you know, she's wearing earrings now, and, you know, it's kind of a cute little scene. Annabeth just acts, you know, confident as ever while they're dancing, and Percy is, you know, this awkward teenage boy, and I like seeing them act just like, you know, teenagers that, you know, are friends, but maybe they kind of like each other, but they don't know. You know, Annabeth is definitely more assertive, and Percy has no idea what to do. So I kind of like that. It kind of depicts, you know, because I think they're only like 13, so that it really kind of reminds me of that age. And then Percy ends up getting separated and captured by a monster in disguise, Vice Principal Mr. Thorne. So he takes Percy, Bianca, and Nico, and we learn that he is working for Luke and the General to gather half-bloods for his army. So Mr. Thorne is revealed to be a manticore, which is a classic Greek mythological creature. So we got a few more new creatures in this book, which I really like. You know, I like it when we get to see these modern takes on these ancient Greek mythological monsters. So Percy tries to communicate with Grover through their empathetic link, which was set up in the second book. And then Annabeth, Thalia, and Grover come in to rescue Percy and the D'Angelo siblings. And they try to fight off the manticore. And Thalia, with her father's shield, Aegis, And then Percy grabs his watch that turns into a shield that Tyson made him at the end of the last book. And they, I believe, are out in the middle of the forest of somewhere in, I think, New York, upstate New York, maybe. And then out of nowhere, we meet the hunters of Artemis, who come in and kind of save the group. Except the Manticore ends up taking Annabeth, and they escape. And Thalia seems to know them, because she knows Zoe Nightshade is one of the hunters. And we get introduced to Artemis, the goddess of the hunt. And in the first book, we were told that Artemis does have a cabin at Camp Half-Blood, but it's empty because she doesn't have any demigod children. Here she mentions that the hunters are kind of like her children, and so they can use the cabin whenever they want. So that's why there is still a cabin there. And the hunters, they have to take a pledge to never grow up, or to be romantically involved, or even really kind of talk with boys at all in any way. Kind of a little bit of the, Peter Pan and the Lost Boys situation going on there. And Artemis appears in the form of, like, a 12-year-old girl. And then Bianca is offered to join the hunters, and she kind of, like, accepts it immediately, almost a little too quickly. And, you know, this part of the book I did not remember at all. I remembered we got the hunters, and I just assumed it was later on in the book. I didn't realize it was, like, right away. And so then Artemis calls her twin brother, Apollo, to help give them a ride to Camp Half-Blood. And so we meet Apollo, the god that flies the chariot over the sun chariot. And so Artemis decides to go off on a hunt for an ancient monster that has been sort of stirring since this whole Kronos has been emerging thing. And so she tells Zoe Nightshade to take the hunters and the Half-Bloods with Apollo back to Camp Half-Blood. And Zoe Nightshade refers to Apollo as being hot, and he kind of comes off as this, like, charming and very flirty. And he immediately takes notice of Thalia, because Apollo and Artemis are also the children of Zeus, and so is Thalia, so technically they're, like, half-siblings. Even though they're, like, really old, and Thalia's not. But Apollo lets Thalia drive the chariot, and Nico's just, like, fascinated by everything, because, you know, he finds out that, you know, this game that he's been playing, MythoQuest or something, has been, like, it's real. Like, all this Greek mythology monsters and the gods are real. So he's just, like, super excited and everything. And it's kind of cute, because he's, like, I think, like, 10 or something. So he's definitely a little kid. And Apollo explains that his chariot is not literally being the sun, but the manifestation of all the hopes and dreams that humanity uses to represent the sun. So I kind of like that explanation of how these Greek myths fit into our modern world. It doesn't completely break the rules of our reality, but rather kind of bends them to fit in with these Greek myths, which I really like. It, you know, it's kind of a cool idea for the world building that is one of the things that I really enjoy about these books. So once at camp, the hunters go to Cabin 8. They're escorted by Grover, and Nico goes to meet Chiron and Mr. D, Dionysus. Mr. D tells Percy there's not going to be a rescue mission for Annabeth, but before Percy can get into trouble for talking back to Mr. D, Chiron tells Percy and Thalia to notify the campers about a game of capture the flag, because it's tradition anytime the hunters of Artemis visit the camp, they always do a capture the flag. And because this is winter break, there's not as many campers. There's not a whole lot of campers that stay year round. They're mostly summer campers, so it's not a lot of campers versus the hunters. And then there's a nice moment between Percy and Thalia where Thalia apologizes for snapping at Percy earlier. He was asking about her birth mother. And so they kind of agree to be co-captains for Capture the Flag, which is a bad idea. But it's a nice moment that kind of allows them to bond, and they kind of, you know, gain an understanding for each other. This kind of goes on a bit throughout the book, where they kind of butt heads a lot, but then they always kind of come back. It's kind of like Percy and Annabeth's relationship in that first book a little bit. And we also learn that Clarice, the daughter of Ares from the last book, she went on a quest just a few weeks, or about a month ago, but she has been missing in action since then. And so that's kind of like a little mystery of like, well, what was Clarice going on a quest for, and why is she gone, why is she captured? And so Percy ends up sending an iris message to his half-brother Tyson, who is in the underwater forge of Poseidon's realm. And so I kind of like that, because Tyson was a big part of the last book. And I like that Percy's kind of like checking up on his brother. And Tyson mentions that the old sea titans are coming back and causing trouble for Poseidon in response to the raising of Kronos. And so that's kind of like an interesting little fact that we're getting throughout the book, is these little nods that, you know, these ancient monsters, because of Kronos is rising, these ancient monsters are kind of coming out of the woodworks and making trouble for the gods and stuff. And we'll see that again progress throughout the book as well. And so Percy ends up with another dream. And I like Percy always has these kind of like, they're kind of like Harry Potter, like where Harry can like kind of see into Voldemort's minds. And like, to him, they're kind of like dreams, but they're like really like visions of what Voldemort was seeing. And Percy kind of like has those, these like prophetic dreams that are kind of like just visions of stuff that's like really happening. And he had that in the first two books, and so he gets a dream about Annabeth in trouble here, with Luke asking her for help, and, you know, given Annabeth's past history and the sort of crush that she had on Luke, he kind of, you know, Luke is kind of plays up on that a bit, and, you know, he tricks Annabeth, but leaves her behind. And so Percy, you know, has these dreams, and he's really concerned that Annabeth's been captured, and so he wants to definitely go on the quest to go find her. And then we also learned that Grover overheard Zoe Nightshade had a dream, or he overheard Zoe Nightshade tell Chiron that she had a dream that the goddess Artemis was also captured by Luke and Kronos. And so Percy thinks that it's definitely not a coincidence that they both had these dreams about Annabeth and Artemis were in trouble. And so Grover tells Percy that Annabeth might have been considering joining the Hunters of Artemis, which is why the Hunters showed up when they did, because it looked like that she had been recruited almost by the Hunters. And so that kind of upsets Percy for some reason. He doesn't like that idea. And so Percy goes to the Oracle of Delphi for advice, but finds the scarf of Aphrodite from the first book that Percy and Annabeth retrieved at the broken down water place in Denver on the Ares side quest. And so the Oracle Delphi doesn't do anything. But so the next day, Percy and Thalia kind of clash as co-captains. They can't really make up their minds during the capture of the flag game against the Hunters. And so the Hunters win, and Thalia's upset with Percy, and both of them kind of like use their special powers against each other. Percy like raises the creek water behind him, splashes Thalia. She retaliates by using her sword to summon lightning and strikes Percy in the chest. And, you know, Percy gets more water, and before they could, like, the fight could escalate, the Oracle of Delphi leaves the attic and meets them in the forest, which is, Chiron says, has never been done. And so the Oracle tells them, specifically talking to Zoe, that 5 should go west to rescue Artemis, 1 shall be lost in a desert, the campers and hunters should work together, and that 1 will perish by a parent's hand. And so far, each book has this quest that sparks the adventure and plot for the rest of the book, and I like that this one isn't for Percy specifically. And so then Chiron calls a meeting to decide which 5 will go west with Artemis, or for the quest for Artemis with Zoe. And so Zoe explains that Artemis needs to be present for the winter solstice meeting on Olympus, because she has been a firm advocate against Kronos. So that's why they really need to go rescue her. And Thalia is still mad at Percy, and Zoe tries to, she doesn't want to work with the campers, she doesn't want to bring them, but the prophecy says they should work together. So they settle on taking 3 hunters, Zoe, Phoebe, and Bianca, and 2 campers, Grover and Thalia, volunteer. Percy feels left out. He feels like he should be on the quest, but of course, he just wants to go search for Annabeth. But Zoe insists that she will not work with the boy, but Grover doesn't count because he's a satyr. So Percy's sad. He goes to call his mom. So he sees his mom, Sally, having like a study date with someone, a man from one of her classes. And Percy kind of like, clearly upset by this. He doesn't like it, seeing his mom on a date. But Sally tells him not to come home and that he needs to go on the quest to save Annabeth. So then we meet Blackjack, which is one of the Pegasus horses that the heroes rescued in the last book from Luke's ship. So, and Percy can understand the Pegasi, just like he can understand the Hippocampi, because Poseidon created horses, and they are enough part horse that Percy can communicate with them. So then we get like a little side thing where Blackjack tells Percy that the Hippocampi are in trouble and they need his help. And so Percy goes out to the sea and he goes like to in the ocean and he finds a creature trapped in fisherman's net. And Percy describes this creature as being part cow, part serpent. So he can't talk to it because it's not part horse. So this is another mythological Greek monster known as the Ophiotaurus, which they don't call it that right away because he doesn't know what it is. It does come into play later on. And so Percy sets the sea cow free and then runs into Nico D'Angelo, who's watching the hunters leave for their quest. And they overhear Zoe Nightshade say that Phoebe was poisoned. And so the group will be down to just the four of them instead of five, like the prophecy said. And so Nico tells Percy that he needs to follow them because they need that fifth person and that he wants Percy to watch out for his sister Bianca. So then Percy takes Blackjack and flies basically from New York to Washington, D.C. on Blackjack. And then he sends Blackjack back home. And so then Percy ends up spotting Mr. Thorn the Manticore from the beginning of the book. And so he kind of follows them. And Percy puts on Annabeth's Cap of Invisibility so he can follow Mr. Thorn, and who was following Zoe and the rest of the group to the Smithsonian. And then this is where we see Luke, and we hear the voice of the general. We still don't know who the general is yet, but Percy recognized the voice from one of his dreams. And so Mr. Thorn tells them that Zoe, Thalia Grover, and Bianca, they're all here at the Smithsonian. And, you know, clearly the general has some sort of plan for them, and he has heard of Zoe, and he's like, don't talk about Zoe. So something happened there. And then the general, like, calls for them to, like, use some bones or some teeth or something from the nearby exhibits to create this, like, army of skeletons. And so Percy then goes to run into Zoe and Thalia and tells the group that Luke and the general are there. And so then they get attacked by the Nemean Lion, another classic Greek monster, the one that Hercules fought. And so Percy grabs some space food from the gift shop and he shoves it in the lion's mouth. And the lion starts kind of like gagging on the food because it's space food. And so while the lion's mouth is open, he's gagging, the hunters end up shooting arrows into the lion's mouth and they defeat the lion. And so the lion kind of turns into dust but leaves behind his coat, and they give it to, Zoe gives it to Percy, and the coat is kind of like bulletproof anyway. So, you know, Percy, you know, is accepted as the fifth member of the quest. And that's kind of where the first half of the book kind of takes off. They do cover kind of a lot of ground here, setting up the hunters and Zoe Nightshade, and also fully meeting Thalia and introducing us to Bianca and Nico. So there's a lot going on in this first half of the book. And we, you know, we kind of suspect something's a little up with Bianca and Nico. We'll learn about that more in the rest of the book. But here it's kind of just teased out. Again, we don't know who the general is. All this stuff is kind of being teased out. And, you know, this idea that these ancient monsters are being, you know, resurrected. And then Artemis went to go find one. And now she's captured. And so there's a lot of mystery going on in this first half of the book. And it's pretty interesting, I think. It's a little bit, I don't want to say slow paced, but it is a little, not enough action, I think, is going on, I think, in these first books. But I do like Percy and Thalia's kind of relationship, how they're kind of like frenemies almost, or sort of antagonistic to each other, but they're also heroes and they know they need to work together and they want to try to understand each other. I like Grover. We learn that Grover, because he's a satyr, he's some kind of obsession with the hunters, so he's always like trying to sneak around and watch them and spy on them, and he's always using his reed pipes, and so it kind of gives a little bit more to the Grover character. He's kind of used as the comedic relief, but also just kind of a little bit more of a satyr-like character in this book than the goofy comedic guy that we had in the first book. So I do like that we're getting to know Grover more. I like Blackjack, the Flying Pegasus, is really cool, and that Percy can talk to Blackjack, and getting to see all these Greek mythological characters, the Manticore, the Nemean Lion, that's really cool. We'll get more of that, and so it's kind of just a nice setup for what the quest is, and then the second half of the book is really kind of going on the actual quest, and hopefully putting some of these mysteries, unraveling the mysteries, and figuring things out. So the first half of the book is not, I think, as interesting, and I definitely didn't remember it. I definitely didn't remember the hunters coming in so quickly, and Bianca being such a big part of it. So it's all been kind of a lot of fun for me to just revisit this book, and it all feels really like new and fresh to me. So I do like that. And so that's it for this review of the first half of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Titan's Curse. And the prophecy does mention that they, you know, whoever returns must survive the Titan's Curse. So that is in the prophecy, and I think we'll learn about exactly what the Titan's Curse is towards the end of the book. But that's going to be it for this review, part one of The Titan's Curse. Stay tuned for part two review. And then part three will just be a wrap-up of the book and the characters as a whole. So thank you all for listening, and come back later for the Percy Jack Son of Poseidon podcast. Thank you.